Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. Today's guest, Deval Patrick. So why am I talking to a former governor of Massachusetts who stepped out of politics? Well, he's someone whom I've been hearing a lot of whispers about among Democrats already thinking toward 2020, even though he has taken no moves to make anyone think he's actually running. At least not yet. But, and I wrote this all up in a story on our political website, that hasn't stopped the hopes. Among the people who told me they've talked to him about running, Obama strategist and close advisor David Axelrod, and Obama's other close advisor and friend, Valerie Jarrett. Plus, as you'll see in that article, Obama himself has encouraged Patrick to think about it. They're actually, truly friends, not just political speak friends. And, as it's been put to me, Patrick is one of the few people out there whom Obama admits has actual political skills. There's a lot that they have in common, though not everything. One thing that struck me is an old Joe Biden line about Obama. He used to say, "I've never met a guy who's better at talking to 10,000 people than one." Patrick is a soaring orator, but he isn't quite Obama level. One potential hitch, if he does decide to do it, has to do with where we recorded the interview. In Boston, at the John Hancock Building, on the 38th floor, in the Bain Capital headquarters. Yes, that same Bain that the Obama 2012 campaign turned into a curse word for Democrats. First, we'll check in on the Massachusetts feeling about Patrick from Lauren Dzinski, who's based out of the State House on Beacon Hill, and the author of our Massachusetts Politico Playbook. Remember to subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Coming up, Alaska Governor Bill Walker, the only independent elected governor in the country, on the future of independent centrists in American politics. And also Cecile Richards of Planned Parenthood, and many more. Follow me on Twitter and on Facebook at Isaac Dover, and keep those emails coming to Isaac, I-S-A-A-C, at Politico.com. Some really interesting guest suggestions coming in. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And now, my conversation with Lauren Dzinski to kick us off. So it feels like in some ways Patrick has disappeared from politics for the moment. Is that the way it feels like in Massachusetts too?
Absolutely. He kind of popped up in 2014, making this, you know, unexpected endorsement in the attorney general's race of all races, throwing his support behind Warren Tolman, who is this, you know, longtime, you know, person who was involved in the Democratic Party, really, you know, a known entity.
But
Warren
who
Tolman
lost.
Actually ended up losing.
Yeah.
Who lost to Maura Healey, who was this, you know, star at this point in the Democratic Party. You know, people are looking at her to run for governor and stuff. But since then, we really haven't heard much of him. And I think that it's kind of this understanding that a lot of it is due to his involvement, you know, with Bain and with the job and kind of with the restrictions that come with that.
I wonder what you think from the people that you're talking to. It's been 2.5 years since he's been governor. We have a Republican governor now. In some ways, Patrick was the aberration for Massachusetts Democrats and actually winning as governor. It's not a state that elects a lot of Democratic governors. Do people think he was a good governor?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because in a state like Massachusetts, it's understood to be really democratic, but it's really more liberal than just capital D democratic. If you look at the voters in Massachusetts, the majority of them are actually unenrolled, so they have no party affiliation. So in terms of Governor Patrick, he's kind of at least initially remembered at the State House as someone who had a lot of conflicts with the House and with the Senate, which is interesting because the House and Senate are both Democratic supermajorities. But there were differences in terms of leadership styles and kind of where Patrick wanted the state to go and, you know, where the House Speaker and where the Senate President wanted. And arguably, they were a little bit more moderate. And now, interesting, we're seeing Governor Charlie Baker, who's a Republican. You know, he has this kind of infamous good relationship, especially with the House Speaker, that, you know, we didn't see with Governor Patrick, even though they were all in the same party.
So I talked to a lot of Obama people about Patrick and the possibility that he would run in 2020, and was surprised at how open many of them were about it. What do you think people in the State House, people who worked with him as governor, or even just people out on the streets in Boston and throughout Massachusetts in a larger way would think about that idea of Deval Patrick, presidential candidate? And maybe if all the things click together in a way that he himself is pushing off as a possibility at this point, it should be noted, that we'd be talking about President
yeah,
Deval Patrick What would people make of that?
I think there's a strong representation of the Deval Patrick diaspora. You know, 8 years in office produces a lot of different people who have a lot of different connections. And so, you know, in Massachusetts, there could be a lot of job opportunities in a federal, you know, Patrick administration that I think, you know, it's like, to be completely honest. However, you know, if anyone who sits down and speaks with Deval Patrick or listens to one of his speeches, you know, the way that he speaks, and you know, it's almost cliche to write about Deval Patrick's soaring oratory, but he really does have that, and he kind of has that special something that mm-hmm. when you interact with him, it makes you kind of wonder, all right, what else do you want? You know, do you actually want to be president? Because I can kind of see that happening. You know, that's you know, third person. That's not me actually saying that.
But if you were to walk out on the streets of Boston and stop people and say, what do you think, Deval Patrick for president? Would people say, you're crazy? Would they say, like, hey, maybe? I don't know. I'm not going to try either of those in a Boston accent, but maybe you want to.
Yeah, I think it's definitely amazing. I think more so now he has been less a part of the political conversation here, you know, around the state house and kind of in the state. We're seeing him pop up in some different spots. He did this event out in Pittsfield on like a Friday night back in like March or April or May, where he talked about his, you know, politics and kind of the state of the country right now. But then, you know, a couple weeks ago, there was a profile of him in the Boston Globe about his beekeeping hobbies. So he's not exactly framing himself as a, you know, someone who is looking to run for governor in a way that you, or run for president, in a way that you see other figures from Massachusetts, like Seth Moulton is making more. So it's, you know, or Elizabeth Warren, you know, they're making more noise. And so I think for the regular Massachusetts resident, you know, there's only so many people on the short list of presidential candidates that you can have here. And I'm just not sure that Deval Patrick is really occupying that space. And to a certain extent, that's because it doesn't seem like he and his people are really pushing that.
Well, Massachusetts grows a lot of presidential candidates, not a lot of actual presidents, but
right. It's fertile ground to a certain extent.
Lauren Dzinski, thank you for taking the time to do this. And now let's take a listen to Deval Patrick try to sort this out for himself. So here we are in the Bain Capital headquarters. This was, wasn't this the nexus of the evil empire for the Obama campaign?
That's where you want to start? let's see. At the time of the campaign, which I co-chaired, very proudly. I didn't participate in all that because I don't think that was the whole story. And I've had an extraordinary experience here starting this new impact investing fund with the enthusiastic support of my new colleagues, and we're investing for both financial return and social and environmental impact, and I think that's the direction business needs to go in. So I'm proud of that. You know, Mitt Romney hasn't been around here for about 30 years or something like that. It hasn't been, maybe not quite that long time anyhow. I think the firm's been around for 30 years, but he hasn't been around for a long time. I've never taken a job yet where I was prepared to or frankly required to leave my conscience at the door, and I'm not starting now.
Did you talk to Romney about coming?
Not about coming. No, I know him, but I don't know him well. I've seen him once since I've been here in the last 2.5 years.
And did he say, it's a good company to join?
Welcome. And yeah, I think he's proud of he ought to be proud of the firm there. A lot of good things have happened here.
Did you talk to Obama about coming?
I did. It was actually pretty funny. I won't get into the details.
Why not? Get into the details.
No. But, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with the former president over the years, and part of our unspoken understanding is that we keep the substance of our conversations to ourselves. But it was funny when I joined the firm. I think it took 2 or 3 days to work out the terms, and 2.5 weeks to figure out how to announce it. for, I think, some of the reasons that you're trying to get at.
Did Obama rib you for coming, though?
No, it wasn't ribbing. It's just, you know, look, it's a...
Are you sure you want to do that kind of
there
stuff?
There are... No, it wasn't like that at all. But I think by the time I talked to him, I had decided I was coming. But, you know, we know how in public life people and institutions get turned into cartoons. And I've tried not to do that in my own public life or in my own personal life for that matter. And I don't fit in a box anyway, so I don't worry too much about it.
When I have talked to people about you, one of the consistent things that comes up is people saying, what is he doing at Bain?
Uh-huh.
So you mentioned a little bit, yeah. but explain what it is that
you
are doing.
So this is a new fund. Actually, we just closed it last week. It's a $390 million private equity fund that invests in smallish companies, small and medium-sized companies, all in North America, where we can generate both a private equity return and a measurable, meaningful social or environmental impact.
So what does that mean? Like, what are you funding?
So we've invested so far in two companies. One is a series of small, low-cost gyms targeted to communities in Michigan and northern Indiana that are so-called fitness deserts, so places of high incidences of obesity and type 2 diabetes, for example, to try to bring an affordable fitness alternative to an underserved community. And we're also trying to help that founder increase utilization up to and including the point of beginning to measure the number of times members get their heart rate up a week, information that, with their permission, we can share with their health insurance companies to start to drive their costs down, make a really virtuous cycle in that respect. That's the objective there. And we're also invested in a company in Texas that diverts organic waste. You know, think of landscape waste and clippings from highway companies and so forth, out of landfills where it would otherwise create greenhouse gas emissions, and into a composting facility where they produce composted soils and mulches.
It seems like one of the things that Democrats are struggling with is what to do about big financial firms, what to do about the sort of Wall Street factor. What do you make of that? Do Democrats have to worry about turning Wall Street, turning the financial sector into the bad guy?
The larger question is, how do we assure an economy that is actually working for everybody? And to me, at a time when economic change is coming so rapidly, it's not the first time in history that that's happened, but it's happening right now in our lifetimes. What we struggle with a little bit is and I don't say this as Democrats, I mean a lot of people who do public policy, is nostalgia. That's what Trump was selling, right? He said his notion, his emphasis in his tagline was on the again,
right?
You know, saying to communities whose factories have left that the solution is to bring that factory back may not actually be the most constructive or even honest pitch to make. And so Democrats who come in and kind of compete at that level, I think we're making a mistake. I think what we need to be doing is thinking about, what do we want the economy to be tomorrow? And how do we shape that? And how do we ensure that everybody has a stake in that? And the fact of the matter is, that's going to be a combination of those big old companies and a whole lot of startups and a bunch of small companies in between. And financial services has a role in making all of that work.
I wonder if you've had any conversations with one of your senators, Elizabeth Warren, who spends a lot of time talking about these issues.
I love her. I think she's fabulous.
So have you talked about this with her?
Some, yeah. I mean, most of the time we're together, we're talking, we're just trash talking, actually. She and her husband and my wife and I get together a couple times a year, and it's great fun.
Trash-talking each other?
Yeah, sometimes each other, but just talking about, you know, the state of politics and of life and what's happening with our grandkids and the rest.
There are people who worry... Democrats who worry, I should say, about her influence on the party of pulling it to the left on these kinds of financial issues. What do you think that that's a concern that that people should have?
I think that You know, as a Democrat, I feel really fortunate that we have a range of voices. We have a range of solutions. I think what really distinguishes us is that we're trying to find solutions and not just and not trying to govern by fear. I don't think governing by fear, though a time-tested strategy, is a good one.
Is Donald Trump governing by fear?
I do believe he is. Yes, I think he certainly campaigned by fear. And by the way, in that respect, he's on trend. Right? We've seen a rise around the world of intolerance and bully-style leadership, and in that respect, I think our president is, as I say, right on trend.
But you're not quite on the same page as Elizabeth Warren when it comes to the question of what
to
do.
We're not the same two people.
Sure.
You know, and by the way, I think about issues. Or I try to solutions comprehensively. I think she does too.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I think you know, sometimes what gets portrayed is an oversimplified version of people in public life. She's a very thoughtful, very serious, very well informed senator. And you know, there have been times when. We've talked about, you know, I'll tell you this. I talked with her about a potential deal we were going to do here that I was afraid had some hair on it, and just tried to get some insights from her on how we should be thinking about it. And it's an issue in a space I won't go into too much detail that she's worked on in the Senate. She was magnificent. Incredibly thoughtful and nuanced, and understood the complexities, and understood what the how to think about the outer boundaries, and so it's a deal we didn't ultimately do, but
she scared you away from it.
No, but for a whole host of reasons, you know, it was just not right in the end for a host of reasons, including financial ones. But those insights and the willingness to help us think about managing around some of the issues. Was just as constructive as you could hope for.
So meanwhile, while you're doing all of this, you're doing the Chicago Police Accountability Task Force. Our police.
That's almost a year ago now.
Do you think that the police in Chicago were being held accountable?
Well, I think that the task force report was extraordinarily detailed and well researched and well supported. I think that there are questions that remain about how aggressive the implementation has been. It was never meant to happen all at once or overnight. I think that the issues in Chicago from a distance and up close are incredibly discouraging, just incredibly discouraging. And I guess I just don't believe that the solution is going to rest with law enforcement alone, or even the style of law enforcement, although I think that's a part of it. And I think that, you know, there are things we know work. You know, community policing actually works. It worked when it was introduced by the Clinton administration, and as long as it was supported and funded and in the places where it's been supported and funded, it works. But it's a long-term strategy.
Does it fall on Rahm Emanuel's shoulders?
Well, everybody bears responsibility for what's happening in Chicago and in other communities where violence is as widespread.
Another thing that I would imagine you're paying some attention to is what's been going on in the Trump administration's approach to civil rights, voting rights, stuff that you were involved in the Justice Department, and closing your eyes, leaning back. What do you make of what's happening there?
Well, you know, I had the incredible opportunity to work in the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division in an administration that actually cared about civil rights.
And, you don't think the Trump administration cares about civil rights?
I don't think that their commitment is the same or indeed very deep. And part of that has to do with my my skepticism of an experience with Jeff Sessions when he was United States Attorney in Alabama. And I litigated against him, and there were decisions around the bringing of that case and the prosecution of that case. This is a voting rights case many years ago.
What was that
criminal
case?
So-called Perry County 3, where three old civil rights activists, black activists in the Black Belt in Perry County outside of Selma, people who had been involved in organizing the Selma to Montgomery march, were criminally charged in voter fraud for helping other old black people file their absentee ballots. And the theory of the government's case and the methods used to prosecute the case were shocking to me even then in the 80s. And I said so when the Attorney General was nominated to the federal bench. And I wrote to the Judiciary Committee when he was nominated to be Attorney General. And I will tell you, I did so somewhat reluctantly, because generally I think presidents ought to have the team of their choice. But what I read about the emphasis or lack of emphasis in the Civil Rights Division, what I'm hearing about the decision to double down on mandatory minimum sentencing, a strategy that has failed, and I don't mean just failed black men, although that is serious enough, but it's failed. It's failed us as a nation. When I read about these things, it gives me just tremendous disappointment in the focus in the Justice Department today on justice itself.
I remember at the 50th anniversary of the Selma March when President Obama went, and I was there.
I was there too.
And then Senator Sessions was there, and that was at a moment when there was an attempt to get some movement back on the voting rights legislation, and after the Supreme Court decision on the Voting Rights Act. And I asked him how he squared being at that ceremony and celebrating the legacy of Selma and being against that legislation. And he sort of deferred and said they don't have anything to do with each other, basically. What do you make of that?
About what you did. I mean, they are connected. You know, I haven't had a lot of conversation with Jeff Sessions over the years. And you know, when I wrote to the Judiciary Committee about his nomination to the Attorney General's position, I acknowledged in that letter that my experience with him was many, many, many years old. And people can grow, and they do, you hope. But there isn't evidence in his tenure today that he has, at least from a policy perspective.
So you wrote an email to some supporters after the election that said you were going to stay woke. Those are your terms.
I think that's what the kids said.
Right, that's what you said in the email, that you were going to stay woke, because that's the expression the kids use. And that you weren't going to reflexively oppose the Trump administration. Have you seen anything that you can support from the Trump administration?
Well, not yet. I do, you know, that occasionally the president has good things to say about the opioid addiction crisis. I think the action steps around that remain to be seen, but it's early days. Remember, he's only been in office
less than 200 days.
Yeah, 6 months. Yeah. So, and that's leadership we certainly need. But we've talked about some of the ways in which, you know, I've been frustrated or even worried, and there are lots of examples on the world stage as well. It's a dangerous and unsettled time, but I don't think it's dangerous and unsettled because of the president alone. I think, though, that if what we need in circumstances like this is are reasons for confidence and for hope and not reminders of being fearful, because fear solves nothing other than political ends. But it solves nothing in terms of actually making people's lives better.
So what are the reasons for confidence and hope in your mind?
Well, look, I think we've had other occasions, as I was alluding to earlier, when the economy has been deeply disrupting of people. This isn't the first time that the economy has left people behind. It's just we decided to pay attention to it because it begun to affect certain communities that hadn't had that experience before. By the way, the opioid addiction crisis was a crisis in a lot of communities before it reached the suburbs. The fact that we have these challenges, I'm saying, is not new. And what we can do and ought to do, and I think what's possible right now, is that so many of the challenges have reached so many more people that the solutions themselves may be opportunities to unify.
Like
so
what?
That rather than saying, you know, we have to find an economy that only serves displaced working white people, finding an economy that works for everybody is actually good for everybody, right? It's and I think there's solutions there that lie in a greater emphasis on innovation and on entrepreneurialism. I think that the you know, everybody seems to agree, from policymakers to regular folks, that we need massive new investment in our infrastructure, it's a platform for private sector growth and ambition. It's also a job creation opportunity, and we can have more than one way to pay for this. It doesn't have to be all public investment or all private investment, but some robust and, in fact, ambitious combination of the two is really important.
Are you surprised that right after the election, that's what we heard? President-elect Trump was going to move on infrastructure right away, and it didn't happen.
Well, it hasn't happened, and whether it will is another story. But there's a lack of focus and discipline that you get out of this White House. I mean, you're nodding your head. You know, I'm not the first person to observe that. I think
anyone would really argue that.
It's
point.
Plain to most people, and I think it's hard to do stuff without emphasis and focus and sustained focus. You know, one of the things. Remember, I'm an amateur. I've only run for one thing.
But you won twice.
And we got a lot done. We had several legislative sessions that were historically productive.
But I'm not sure that any two-term governor can really say I'm an amateur.
But you understand what I'm saying.
You're not a political professional.
I haven't had a whole career in elective office. But a lesson which I learned slowly is that these jobs are a combination of substance and performance art. And I resisted the performance art part of it for a long time, Isaac, because it felt like that was it trivialized the substance. I began to realize you had to have the performance art in many quarters in order to get any attention paid to the substance. The hazard is when the performance art overtakes the substance.
And that's what you see happening.
And
here.
That is what I'm worried about today. And it's not just in the White House. I think we see this broadly in American politics today.
But to come back to one of the things you were talking about, the whole Democrats need to focus on the white working class argument, which is the most consistent line that's come since the election. That to you is not compelling.
Well, I think the notion that that the strategy for success, either politically or from a policy point of view, is about segmenting the public, you know, saying a little of this over here and a little of that over there so that nobody gets aroused, and, you know, blurring the lines between yourself and somebody else. And I just, to me, as a citizen, that feels tiresome and hackneyed. And the question ought to be, it's back to this point that there some of the big challenges that we're focused on right now are challenges that affect everybody. So how do we think about solutions that are good for everybody and that are opportunities in and of themselves to unite us?
You also talked after in that email right after the election about Trump unleashing something dark during the campaign. And this is something that a lot of people thought about and wrote about, and I did during the campaign. But you haven't seen exactly what the effect of that is, or do you think we have in the time since he's been president? There was a lot that was churned up that way during the campaign, but have you seen it?
I don't think it's right that we haven't seen it. I'm not sure it's been reported on because I don't think you see it in. I don't think you see it in. In broad sort of camera ready examples, but talk to people. Listen to what people who already felt vulnerable say they experience now.
What are your interactions with
their coworkers? What kids hear from their pals at school that they didn't used to hear before? The kind of even some of what's happening on campuses. And I would include in this, by the way, the intolerance that our friends on the left have had for voices on the right. The right feels and I mean the extreme right feels much more present and much more threatening. And if you are a person who already felt marginalized or vulnerable, then you feel even more so today. And I don't think that's the character of the country that we ought to want.
Are you hearing those stories from people that you're talking to?
Sure. Yeah, I hear them from my, I hear them from my family members.
What are they telling you?
From my friends. They tell me about what they overhear, commuting on the T, on the subway, how they get treated in stores,
Feeling a rise in racism.
They're hearing language that. We used to think was inappropriate about you read in local news anyway, reports about the defacing of school buildings or cemeteries. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying, as I said, that there are so many of these that they are kind of camera ready and getting the attention of the evening news. But I guess the point I'm making is this: the more I've thought about it, the more I'm persuaded that our democracy depends on unwritten rules, rules around decorum and restraint and duty and civility and respect. And a lot of those rules have been cast aside
by Trump
in this moment. And this is something I think he touched. And this is something leadership can touch to the bad and to the good. And I think we ought to want and indeed that we need as Americans a more exemplary kind of leadership than we're getting today.
Do you think the Democratic Party's learned anything since the election and from the election?
I can't speak for the Democratic Party.
But as a Democrat these issues.
I can tell you what I think some of the lessons are. I think, number one, elections aren't about math. They're about people, all kinds of people from all quarters of the country. And this notion of, having a few places where we focus in and pay attention from a political point of view. I'm not saying from a policy point of view, from a political point of view. May be efficient, but it's dumb.
You mean like swing states, like that? That's what you're talking about?
We just care about Ohio,
North Carolina.
You got to have these many of that place and these many of that place, and it'll all add up, and it's fine. It's a big country, but the whole country is at stake, not just the corners of concentrated Democratic votes. The whole country is at stake. And I think we as Democrats have to project that we understand that and care about that. Secondly, I think it's always important to listen. And while we've been spending so much time, it feels to me as a party, comparing our taglines and talking points to and slogans to the other side, it would do us well to do what I think a lot of Democratic office holders at the local level do, which is get closer to people and listen. Let them tell us how they need government, not to solve every problem in their lives, but to help them help them help themselves. And the third thing is, it's not a new lesson, but you know I say it's not a new lesson, and I'm getting to our economic, in quotes, message. And the reason I say it's not a new lesson is because I think history will show that the economy tends to do better under Democratic leadership than it does under Republican leadership historically. But I think speaking to people about how you rebuild an economy that works for everybody, and that you do it fearlessly, not being so undone by the speed of change right now that we can't be about shaping our own future. I think that's enormously important for Democrats, and that is why it seems to me there's a lot of appeal to Democratic messaging Democratic Party values in this office. And in offices like it all around.
In this office in Bain's office.
Yes. And in places like it that I have worked in all around the country. Because people understand fundamentally that we have a stake in our neighbors' dreams and struggles as well as our own. And Democrats, I think, fundamentally are about rebuilding community.
There must be people who voted for you in 2006, that was your last, and in 2010, and voted for Barack Obama in 2012 and 2008, and voted for Donald Trump in 2016. Do those voters make sense to you?
Yeah, to some extent. To some extent. I'm not an expert, as I say, but I don't believe that all or maybe even most of the people who voted for Donald Trump responded to the, you know, were just about hate. I think that there were a lot of voices of a lot of votes from people who just didn't feel heard or seen. And I get that. I really, really do. And I think part of the irony, bitter though it is that some of those very people are like the people I have known all my life from the South Side of Chicago or whom I met when I was campaigning or just living in different parts of the country and working in different environments, who also felt unseen and unheard. And I think that the party and the candidate who prevails is the party and the candidate, not just whose policies, but whose way of politicking is about paying attention to people who feel as if attention hasn't been paid. And when we do, we win, and we deserve to win.
All right, let's talk about you for a second. A lot of people around President Obama want you to run for president.
Yeah. I see our time is up.
Valerie Jarrett even said, I'm sure you saw that a couple of weeks ago, that conference in Las Vegas, the SALT conference, she named you as her candidate for 2020. Someone who worked for the president in the White House when he was there said to me that if you got in, the center of gravity would shift among operatives around Obama, that they would rush to you. What do you tell them?
Wow. Well, thank you for all that.
I didn't. Those are other people talking.
That's incredibly powerful. I'm focused on what I'm doing right now. That's a commitment I've made to my investors, and I've made to my colleagues, and I've made it to my family. I'm trying to think about how to be helpful, because I care about the country and I'm a patriot first. And it's way, way too soon to be making plans for 2020. So I'll just leave it at that.
Did you make a time commitment to the people here at Bain and to your family?
No. No.
You just made a commitment that
sort of an out of
bounds. Right, like I'm committed to Bain through 2019.
No.
But is it something that is possible in your mind?
You know, don't lead me down that path, because it turns into something it isn't, and I don't want to go there. Look, you will, and maybe some of your listeners will roll your eyes when I say this, but there isn't a day that goes by that I don't remember where I came from. You know, growing up on welfare on the south side of Chicago, and to have someone like you report the things said about me that you just did is a very humbling thing.
From an office where we're looking out on Boston.
I know, as my grandmother would say, look at us now. But it's a very humbling thing. And I kind of want to dishonor that by blowing it off, but I have no plans. And I have no plans to make plans.
Has President Obama said anything to you about it?
Now, see, didn't I tell you earlier that we talk about a whole bunch of things, but we don't talk about what the substance of those conversations are?
You can just do it with mime if you want.
Okay. Your colleague has a camera in the room.
One of the other things that I have been told is that Barack Obama is not a guy who is very impressed by most people's political skills, but that you are one of the few that he thinks actually has real political skills.
Wow. Well, that's very kind. Now, he's never said that to me.
Maybe he just tells that to other people. So you'll say what he hasn't said to
you. Yes, indeed. That's indeed. That's very kind.
So the argument, though, whoever is the candidate in 2020, the argument against Donald Trump is going to be what in your mind?
You know, due respect, Isaac, I hope that for the nominee, that isn't the question.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, I think we can't be just about what we're against. We have to be about what we're for. And I think offering an alternative vision for the future of this country and the role of government alongside the private sector, alongside philanthropy, alongside individuals exercising their free creativity is enormously important. And we can do that as a party. We have done it in the past, and we can do it again, and I think we have to win.
All right. Deval Patrick, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Deval Patrick, straight from Bain Capital headquarters. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Bridget Mulcahy, who makes all this possible, and our intern, Rachel Cusick. Remember to subscribe and rate us for those new episodes coming up, Alaska Governor Bill Walker, Cecile Richards, and more. And catch you next time on Off Message.